All right, let's start. What do we see here? Here we see a picture that the Hubble Space Telescope took of the so-called tadpole galaxy here in the foreground. And it is about 420 million light years away. On the other hand, what you see in the background is mostly, almost exclusively, galaxies. There could be a few stars in there, but generally it is galaxies. So each of those little spots is a galaxy. Now, if this one is 420 million light years away, these tiny specks over there are galaxies that are more than a billion light years away. The universe itself is 13.8 billion years old. Okay, so we want to describe what's going on there. And this is an indication that space is curved, because what you see here is the effects of gravitational lensing. If you look closely, you see those stripes here, these things there. And they arise because light from a galaxy that's far away, such as one of those tiny specks, has been lensed by a big galaxy in the foreground, like this one, or like that one. They can lens. So you see, a galaxy will curve the space around it, and that leads to an effect similar to what the lens would do. And in this way, we can see a galaxy that's far behind it, because it's not a proper focusing, it's not a proper lens that has been shaped in the proper way, we can see multiple images of that. So this would be light from the same galaxy as that, or that, or that. One can actually use these so-called Einstein rings to map out the lens itself. Often we don't really see the lens itself. It might be a lot of dark matter. It might be a small galaxy that has, as usual, more dark matter than it has luminous matter. And these rings help us map out where the dark matter is. OK, so what is the mass that allows us to describe a curved space-time and how it moves and how this all behaves towards the extremes? Extremes such as the beginning of the universe and such as black holes, for example. So this course will have three parts. And the first part is the mathematical tools. Part A is mathematical tools for general relativity. We spend quite some time on that. And then the part B, the second part, will be general relativity. So we apply those tools to describe general relativity with the most modern mathematical methods. And then the third part is applications to cosmology and to black holes. So let's go through that in some detail. How will we go about the math part? So I will give you a brief overview of what we will cover in these three parts. What will we cover in the math part, and then what will we cover in the general relativity part, and then what will we cover in the cosmology part of this course. In the math part, the strategy will be this. We will build things up from scratch, from the most elementary definitions, almost the most elementary definitions. So in order to describe space-time, we will start with a mere set, a set of points, which will then correspond to the set of events. We will start with a mere set of points, and then we add structure to that. We will add the notion of open neighborhoods. This will allow us to define what is called a topology on the manifold, on that set. And then we will introduce a concept called separability. And once we have these, we can then define the notion of continuity. You may think, oh, I know what continuous means. Yeah, probably. But there are surprises about continuity. And one we will see in this lecture today. Another is, for example, in quantum mechanics. I just want to make you aware that these things are not trivial. So for example, continuity. Take a linear map, such as a linear map described by a matrix. Is it continuous? Is this a continuous function? You feed in a vector, you get a vector out. Is that continuous?
I mean, every finite dimensional vector space, every linear map is continuous, right?
In finite dimensions, yes. In finite dimensions, every linear map is continuous. But you know that in quantum mechanics, we are forced to deal with infinite dimensional vector spaces, right? And there, you would deal with operators that have matrix representations. Some of those operators will be continuous. I mean, they're always linear, right? But some of them will be continuous, some will not be. The position operator, not continuous. Momentum operator, not continuous. Angular momentum, not continuous. Right? So continuity is a non-trivial concept. Even though linearity doesn't guarantee it. And the reason is that, just talking about Hilbert spaces, if you can change the input vectors to an operator such as the momentum operator just a tiny little bit, and the output, the result of applying the operator, can change by arbitrarily much. That's what happens for unbounded operators, such as the position operator, momentum operator, and so on, and therefore they're not continuous. So be prepared that these things are not trivial. And then we define differentiability of a manifold. Not differentiability of a function, but the differentiability of the manifold itself. With these things, we can then proceed to define tangent spaces, cotangent spaces, tensor spaces, and so on. And eventually, we aim towards the notion of curvature. And curvature we will define as the non-triviality of parallel transport, right? So if on Earth you move this way and that way, or you move first move north and then west, don't arrive at the same, no, you will, okay, that's a different story. But if you parallel transport a point on a parallelogram, then the parallel transport might not be trivial. There might be a deficit angle, and that's one way of characterizing curvature. It's not the only way, though. And since curvature is gravity, it's a very important concept, so we will describe curvature in multiple ways. One way is to describe curvature as non-triviality of parallel transport. Other ways are the curvature is also recognizable by the sum of the angles in a triangle not being 180 degrees. That's another way of discovering that there's curvature. Another way to discover that there's curvature is to check whether Pythagoras' law holds. If not, we suspect curvature, right? Curvature can also be interpreted as the emergence of tidal forces. Tidal forces are also curvature. And the mathematics of that is the so-called sectional curvatures, which are like Gauss curvature, but generalized to higher dimensions. Curvature can also be described in yet another way that we will also cover later on. Namely, curvature can also be described as the non-trivial sound that an object makes when you tap it. Let's say you take a vase for flowers, empty though, and you take a spoon and bang on it. Then it will make a certain sound. It will emit certain frequencies, the resonance frequencies of this glass. If you change the shape, you're changing the resonance frequencies. In other words, what that means is that knowledge of the resonance frequencies gives you knowledge about the curvature. It's an old field called spectral geometry that studies how can we hear information about the curvature in the sound that an object makes. You may wonder, yeah, but that's about flower vases. How about space-time? The thing is that the flower vases don't oscillate on their own. You have to take a spoon to hit them. Space-time doesn't require a spoon. There are quantum fields on it that fluctuate all the time. They are always being tapped by little spoons, the spoons being the quantum fluctuations of space-time. So we will see that there is a way to describe curvature also in terms of the quantum fluctuations of space-time. Personally, I think that describing curvature through this method, the spectral geometric method, is particularly promising because spectral geometry is about functional analysis, about the spectra of operators. In other words, we describe the mathematics of general relativity, curvature, in terms of the mathematics of quantum theory, which is spectra and operators and their spectra and their eigenfunctions and all that. So we'll get to this too. And then curvature can also be described, and that's a little too early to explain to you at this point how that works, but curvature can also be described as non-trivial entanglement in the vacuum fluctuations. It's essentially going back to what I said earlier. Space-time doesn't need a spoon to make it ring. Quantum fluctuations do that already. The quantum fluctuations in space-time are entangled with each other. They're correlated more than classically. And if you know the correlations among quantum fluctuations in the space-time, you can infer what the curvature is. So you see where this is going. This is going towards describing general relativity and quantum theory with the same mathematical language, which is interesting because we don't have a theory that would unify general relativity and quantum theory. But it must exist, and it must be one framework. It must be one mathematics that describes both, that in a limiting case gives you GR, in a limiting case gives you quantum field theory. So it's interesting to look into those two. Okay. Then in this next part, after we've done all of the mathematical framework, I want to say one more thing about the mathematical framework. What we'll do today and next time is going to be the toughest, driest, most boring looking mathematics of this course. We start off with that, and then it gets better from there, all right? And you may wonder, why do we do this? Well, we do it because I wanted to show you the foundational definitions, not in the detail that pure mathematicians would do it, but just so you know what goes into it to build the fundamentals, the basics, the foundation to build general relativity on it, differential geometry and then general relativity on it. I think that's important because even an airline pilot should know how a jet engine works. Right? Even though the airline pilot is not the one to repair it, he or she should know how this works in principle. And even if we just use general relativity, we should know what's the engine in there, how does it really work. And ultimately, we will have to repair this anyway. We will have to go beyond these things because we know that general relativity as it stands fails at the singularity in the black hole or fails at the Big Bang singularity, we know that it's not quantum. So something has to give, and it's good to know what we have at the moment, what it is resting on, what are the foundations. Okay, so that was about part A that we will start today. And then part B. Once we have the mathematical tools, we will then introduce and study general relativity. And we will formulate general relativity in with the most modern method. So we will study the equations of motion, of curvature, or of the metric, but also the equations of motion for scalars, vectors, and spinners on the space-time. We will study the symmetries of space-time. Often it is a good idea to make simplifying assumptions of symmetries. And then we obtain conservation laws. In reality, these symmetries are only approximate. For example, translation invariance is clearly not true in the universe because stars and galaxies, they mess with the space-time. They put curvature in there. But overall, it's pretty flat. And that gives us an overall almost conservation of momentum and of energy. But in reality, of course, energy is not conserved. Right? That's one of the things we will find, that in general relativity, energy is not conserved, neither is momentum, neither is angular momentum. But we will see that it's almost conserved, unless if space-time is changing really fast and there are really non-trivial things going on. But in principle, conservation laws are non-trivial now. Then we will study general relativity in the tetrad formulation, which allows us to understand general relativity as a gauge theory. The point here is the following. Remember how you studied quantum mechanics. You probably first encountered it in a course that showed you the Schrödinger equation, and then you solved the Schrödinger equation for the harmonic oscillator and the step potential and stuff like that. Everything happened in the coordinate basis. maybe towards the end you saw the momentum basis, right? But if you really want to understand quantum mechanics, the position basis is no good. The momentum basis is not good. It's good for practical purposes, the one or the other representation. For the harmonic oscillator, for sure, you have seen the energy eigenbasis. But if you really want to understand quantum mechanics, you need to understand it basis independently. Right? You need to understand that you have operators such as position, momentum operators, angular momentum operators, and so on, that are objects in themselves, which can then be represented as multiplication, differentiation operators in the one or the other representation. But there's an abstract structure behind it. And then the details are the representation theory of that. And similarly with general relativity. We don't want to be tied to have it in a particular coordinate system and always coordinate systems, right? We need to have some freedom here. For example, in the elementary descriptions of general relativity, including the one that Einstein came up with, for example, the choices of bases in the tangent spaces were automatically tied to the choice of coordinate system. There's no reason to actually tie them this way. And in the tetrad formalism, we free ourselves from that tie. So we can choose coordinates whichever way we want, or no coordinates too. And then we can still choose bases and the tangent, cotangent spaces, whichever way is convenient. It's similar to quantum mechanics, where we can choose whatever basis we want or no basis at all for some calculations. Yeah, and then we will study singularities and their unavoidability. Roger Penrose got a Nobel Prize for stuff that we will cover there. And then once we have done general relativity, we will do applications of it to cosmology and to black holes. So we will do a classification of exact solutions. There are exact solutions for various cosmological models. We will find some surprises in there that one would not have seen perturbatively. Models of cosmological matter. You know, the different epochs in the universe were dominated by different matter. There was an epoch of plasma and of radiation and of matter, and an epoch of cosmological constant domination. We will study those. And then more and more realistic Friedmann, Robertson, Walker models, the kinds that we now use to describe cosmology. And we will use the tetrad formalism as an exercise to see an application of it. The tetrad formalism you might otherwise use, for example, for attempts to do quantum gravity. And then we will eventually arrive at cosmic inflation, which is currently the best theory we have for the origin and evolution of the universe. And pretty wild things there in cosmic inflation. In fact, the course that I will teach next term, Quantum Field Theory for Cosmology, will start with quantum field theory and then end up with cosmic inflation. And then we will see that the distribution of matter in the universe, the distribution of galaxies in the universe, is not like the distribution of raindrops on a dry road. If the rain starts on a dry road, you see a distribution of raindrops, right? And you can study what the statistics of that is. This is a Poisson statistics. It's a particular kind of statistics that comes from pure randomness, right? That's not how galaxies are distributed. This is not how the cosmic microwave background's radiation spectrum is distributed in the sky. It's a non-trivial different distribution. And it is the distribution that you predict and was predicted on the basis of the idea that quantum fluctuations of a scalar field in the very early universe seeded those fluctuations, right? It's very cool. It means that the distribution of matter, ultimately of us, right, goes back to quantum fluctuations. And so in this course, we will prepare the general relativity part of that discussion. Okay, so now let's start with the first part, with the mathematical tools for general relativity, right? I mean, I just reviewed, we will do the mathematical tools, we will do general relativity, we will do applications. And now let's actually do it and start with the mathematical tools. Oh, let's close the door there. Okay, so space-time is best described as what is called a differentiable manifold. This concept goes back to Riemann in the 1850s, Poincaré 1890s, Whitney 1930s, and others. In order to find out what a differentiable manifold is, let's start by defining what an n-dimensional topological manifold is and then add structure to it until we arrive at differentiable manifolds. Now, in the next few pages, it's going to be pretty technical, but remember, this is not meant to be a machine to be used. It's like you're the pilots. You need to know roughly what goes on in a jet engine, but you don't have to actually be able to repair it. So this is more like for information. And let's just start already with a sentence that's not meant to be understandable unless if you studied this before. All right, it's going to be full of words that we will have to define. And that sentence is that an n-dimensional so-called topological manifold, let's call it M, is what is called a Hausdorff space, which is locally homeomorphic to Rn. So that's what you will find in textbooks on differential geometry. But what the heck does it mean? It means, roughly speaking, that a differentiable manifold, n-dimensional topological manifold is something that looks, if you look at it with a microscope, that is to say locally, it looks like Rn, right? So it is in some sense like Rn. And homeomorphic means that there's a continuous map that runs from our topological manifold to Rn locally. Locally, you can map them to each other in a continuous way. And Hausdorff means that points in that space are distinguishable. Okay, so let's go through this in more detail. So what is a topological space M? What does the word topology mean? First of all, in mathematics, the word topology has two meanings. For example, the topology of a donut is different from a topology of a sphere. Donut has a hole, the sphere doesn't. Now, that's global topology. That's one use of the word topology. The word topology also has a different meaning, and that's the meaning that we need here. A topological space M, and you can think of it as the set of events in practice, that's what it's going to be, the set of events in the space-time. A topological space M is a set together with a specification of subsets, let's call these subsets U index I, which will be called open sets. And in order to qualify to be called open sets, these subsets must have these two properties. Namely, that the intersection of any two of these supposed open subsets has to be an open subset, again, has to be in that in that set of the UIs. And also, the union of any number of them has to be also an open subset. This is all there is to it, which means you can, if you want, think of this as the real line and then open intervals, for example. They would have that property. And if you take the intersection of them and the union, then it would have that property. But it doesn't have to be. You could even have discrete sets and then define subsets among them that would have that, that property. As always in mathematics, definitions we try to keep as general as possible. Because then, wherever the definition matches, our conclusions from the abstract framework can be applied. You know, for example, there are theorems about vector spaces, where you don't have to specify even a dimension of it. That's really cool, because it means that for whatever vector space, a vector space of functions, a vector space of three-component vectors, whatever theorem you have about vector spaces in general will apply to all of them. And so similarly, if you have a topological space, and you can prove something about it, it will apply to all topological spaces, right? Okay, so a topological space is just a set where we specify, and that to specify these subsets is to give the set a topology, right? We specify a set of subsets, UI, and if they obey these two properties, then we will call that set of subsets open subsets. The set of open subsets, and then overall we say that the space has been equipped with a topology. Nothing to do with the donut versus sphere thing, right? This is a different story here. Different use of the word topology. Now, a topological space M, that is to say a set equipped with singling out subsets that have this property, therefore the set has a topology. A topological space M is called Hausdorff, or we say it has the Hausdorff property, if it is separable, which is to say if X and Y are elements of our topological space and X is not equal to Y, well then X and Y are elements of this joint open set. The intuition behind that is, let's say you have the real line. You have the real line here. And you have two points, X and Y. And the real line has the Hausdorff property, which means that since this point, X, and this point, Y, are not the same, there is an open set around X, for example, from here to here, and an open set around Y, for example, from here to here, such that these two open sets do not overlap. So they are separable. This is a definition that's needed because if you only define a topology this way, you can have a topology where two points can be different, and yet they cannot be separated by open sets. Here is the same statement in pure mass notation in case you want to see that. Pure mass notation is cool because in principle it doesn't rely on a language, right? Because you could just, you know, the for all symbol, the excess symbol, and so on, right? Can be read in all languages. Okay, so then, for example, Rn is a topological space that is Hausdorff with regards to these definitions, and open sets are literally what you know from calculus to be open sets. So, you know, for example, sets of points around a point, you have an open set consisting of all those points that have a distance smaller than some epsilon from that point. All right, now that we have a topology, we can define the term homeomorphic. Why do we care about the term homeomorphic? It's because the definition of a manifold, of a differentiable manifold, requires this. Namely, we started out with saying that an n-dimensional topological manifold, so far we just have topological space, topological manifold is a Hausdorff space which is locally homeomorphic to Rn, meaning that a curved space-time should locally look like Rn, in some sense locally like Rn, and that the technical term for that is homeomorphic. And what homeomorphic means is equivalent under a continuous map, or isomorphic with respect to a continuous invertible map. So here we are. Let's make this precise. So I just said that Rn, with its usual definition of open sets, is such a topological space. But now we need also to understand the word homeomorphic. In order to understand the word homeomorphic, we need to understand the word continuity. Again, remember, continuity is a non-trivial concept. So if A and B are topological spaces, then a map that maps the elements of one topological space into the elements of another topological space is called continuous. And remember, these topological spaces could be R2 and R2, for example, just to give an example, right? So this could be a map from Rn into Rn. But it's much more general. So what we say is that if A and B are topological spaces, such as Rn, then a map F from one topological space into another topological space is called continuous if, when a subset U of the space B is an open set, then the pre-image under F of that open subset, which is in A, is also an open set. That's a slightly non-trivial perhaps conditioned, but maybe I should just remind you of what that means, the pre-image. If U is a subset of B, then the pre-image of U consists of all those points that F maps into B. So it's just, you know, what the image is of a set, right? And the pre-image just goes into the other direction. And here's an example. So here, the topological spaces are R and R. So A is R, and B is also the real line. And then let's say we choose for, so here are the input values, right? This is the A, this is R, A. And this is, these are the output values, and here we have a function. That function is not continuous because it goes all the way to here, reaches that point, 3, right? At 3, it reaches the value 2, and then it continues here from 4 onwards. But of course, the function f cannot have two values at 3. So at 3, it has the value 2. And then at any point to the right of 3, it is following that curve, right? And this little circle means, no, that's not where it takes the point value. It takes it here. OK, so that's our function f. And we want to see whether we can detect that it is a discontinuous function using that definition here. So for that, we want to choose, we want to see if we can find a set of, a subset of B. So that is to say, a subset of this real axis, which is open, and yet its pre-image is not open. Right? So let's choose for you the interval from open to 3, from 1 to 3, the open interval from 1 to 3. Okay? So the output values from 1 to 3. Okay. So that's an open set from 1 to 3. What's the pre-image of that? So which points on this axis map into values from 1 to 3? Well, it starts here. Right, so let's add, it starts at 1.5. This is where the output value is 1. So it goes from 1.5 onwards, but not exactly 1.5 because it would take the point 1, but the point 1 is not included. It's an open interval, right? And then it goes all the way to 3. You see, the values from 2 to 3 are never taken, right? This function never outputs a value between 2 and 3. So this means that the pre-image of the open interval from 1 to 3 starts at 1.5 without including 1.5, and then it goes all the way to 3. Right? It goes all the way to 3, and at 3, that value is taken 2. And then the other values between 2 and 3 are just never taken, so the pre-image of the open interval from 1 to 3 is this interval. But it's not open. It's closed over there. Right? So we have shown in this example that this definition actually detects discontinuities in the intuitive ordinary sense. Again, I'm not going to examine you on that sort of thing. The point is to get an idea of how this jet engine works, what is behind it, that we're not defining continuity in the naive way where we would say, oh, yeah, it just jumps or something. No, it's a definition that doesn't require any coordinates, for example. It just says subsets, right? So it's a more powerful definition in that regard. Okay. So this is a powerful definition of continuity that can be applied very generally, not just for Rn. It will also be applicable, for example, for manifolds, as we will see. So having this definition of continuity is very useful for us because it means we can now use that to generate the definition of continuously parametrizable, of coordinate systems, of mapping a space-time manifold locally onto a patch of Rn. So let A and B be topological spaces. Then a function from f, a function f that goes from A to B, for example, this could be a space-time manifold, and this could be a piece of Rn or just all of Rn. So let A be, let A and B be topological spaces, then a function f that maps from one topological space into the other is called a homeomorphism. And notice that there's an E in here. Homeomorphism is a much more general definition that just says axioms here are obeyed over there as well. Homeomorphism means that the continuity notion, that the set of open sets is respected. It's called a homeomorphism if F inverse exists and if both F and F inverse are continuous. So we say that A is locally homeomorphic to B, and A, what we have in mind, I mean, this is totally general, but what we have in mind is that A might be a spacetime manifold. A might be a differentiable manifold. So we say that A is locally homeomorphic to B, and that would be Rn, if for all points in A, like events, there exists an open neighborhood, let's call it U index P of that point. So of that point means that P is a point that's actually in there, so the open neighborhood contains P, which is homeomorphic to an open set in B. So we would say that for example, a space-time or a topological space is homeomorphic to Rn if for all points in that topological space, in other words, for all events in space-time, there exists a neighborhood around that point which is homeomorphic to an open set in B. So let me... You have a question?
Okay, just solve it.
Okay. All right, great. Okay, so then the definition is that an n-dimensional topological manifold, right, and we're getting closer and closer to the definition that we want, which is differentiable manifold. So the definition then is that an n-dimensional topological manifold is a Hausdorff space which is locally homeomorphic to Rn. Remember, we had that sentence at the beginning, and I said it's full of words that we didn't define, but in the meantime, we defined it, right? Topological manifold means that it has a topology, so we have a set of subsets defined on it. And it has to be Hausdorff, so points need to be separable, like this. And it's locally homeomorphic to Rn, which means that for every point, there is a neighborhood in which there are continuous invertible maps between our topological manifold and Rn. You may wonder, but isn't Rn flat? And don't we allow spacetime to be curved? So how can they be homeomorphic? The thing is that in homeomorphism, it's just a continuous map. It doesn't mean that curvature is preserved under that map. The only thing that's preserved is the epsilon neighborhood structures. Right? It's the only thing that's preserved is the topology. The only thing that's preserved is, you know, what is in a neighborhood and the continuity, right? So this does not care about curvature. We're just saying that the continuity structure is the same.
Also, I have a question. So is this related to the local flatness theorem? Or is it not the same?
No. Because we can do all of what we've done so far for manifolds on which curvature and a metric is not even defined. Right? The structure hasn't been given it. So the only thing that we are describing so far is sets which have open sets, subsets, right? And how they might relate to Rn, whether there's a continuous map between them.
We don't even have a concept of flatness or...
There is no concept of flatness, there is no concept of distance, and so on. In other words, if we have such a topological manifold, then what we mean by it hasn't got a metric, it hasn't got a curvature, what we mean by that is we can add it, and we can add many different kinds of that. I mean, for example, you could take a carpet and you could roll it up in many different ways and turn it into something more curved, right? And similar like that, we have only the property of things hang together in a continuous way. You can take the same topological manifold and give it different metrics, different curvatures.
Is that because we are specifying it's locally homeomorphic to Rn? Had it been over a larger area, then we would have a metric.
No. The metric is a separable structure. It's a separate structure on it. In fact, we don't even have a notion of small or large area because we don't have a notion of distance here. Right? For example, if we map into Rn, we could map the entire manifold into maybe a tiny piece of it, or we just rescale things and maps into a big part of Rn. This is only tracking the continuity of it, that there are no gaps. That's the only thing that this is really tracking. Okay, so now we want to upgrade that to a definition of the term differentiable manifold. Now we know how to differentiate functions. How the heck? I mean, we know how to define what we mean by differentiability of a function, and we know that just because the function is continuous doesn't mean that it's differentiable. Now we have a notion of what it means that a manifold is continuous. You know, it's a topological manifold which is locally homeomorphic to Rn. That means the manifold is continuous. But now we want to describe differentiability of a manifold. And just because a manifold is continuous may not guarantee that it's differentiable. But, you know, a manifold is usually where you define functions on. But here, we've just managed to describe the continuity of the manifold. Now, how do we define differentiability of the manifold? And there we will find that there is a fundamental difference between differentiability of a manifold and differentiability of a function. If a function, for example, is 5 times continuously differentiable, meaning that you differentiate it 5 times, you can do that, and the result is still continuous, right? Then there is no guarantee that that function is 6 times differentiable or 7 times differentiable, right? So every function has a property of being differentiable, continuously differentiable so many times. And then at some point is usually it ends. For some functions, such as the exponential or the sine or the cosine, well, they are infinitely many times continuously differentiable. They are C infinity functions, right? A similar question arises here. Manifolds can be continuous. That's what we covered. So that means they are locally homeomorphic to Rn. So they inherit the continuity properties of Rn. Because remember, homeomorphism means there's an invertible map, right? It goes from the manifold to Rn, from Rn to the manifold, so the continuity is inherited. But how about differentiability, and what does it mean that the manifold is 5 times continuously differentiable? Okay, so a local homeomorphism, for this we need to, okay, let me give you the overall strategy of it. We know what differentiability means for functions. And what we'll do is we will recruit that definition to apply it to manifolds themselves. And for that, we need a trick, which is super useful also for other reasons, which is so-called charts or coordinate systems. Because coordinate systems are tools to map points on the manifold into tuples of numbers. And then functions will become functions among numbers. And we know how to differentiate them, right? So let's get numbers involved. Let's get charts or coordinate systems involved. We need them anyway, but let's keep in mind we are trying to define differentiability of manifolds, and it's useful for that too. So a local homeomorphism from a topological manifold U into Rn, so this could be a space-time manifold. So a local homeomorphism, which means a continuous invertible map from U, which could be a subset of a space-time, into Rn, is called a chart of that topological manifold. And so what does that do? if you have an n-dimensional topological manifold, H will map every point in that set U into an n-tuple of numbers. And that's what is a chart. That is a coordinate system. I should probably move this thing so that I won't be locked out of it. So that's what a coordinate system is, right? So the points of the manifold get mapped into n tuples. And then for any point q in the topological manifold, its image in Rn is a set of n numbers that we may call x1 to xn, and they are called the coordinates. So far, so good. You know all of this. let me illustrate this. So here is the topological manifold M, and U is some subset of it, is some region of space-time, for example. And then we assume that we have a homeomorphism from U into Rn. Let's call that homeomorphism H. This homeomorphism H is also called a local coordinate system for U. Local because U doesn't cover all of the manifold, it just covers a piece of it. We may wish to have one coordinate system that covers all of it, but we have to be careful because for some m's, that's just not possible. There is no single coordinate system that would cover all of it, like for a donut. So you can't do it. So, so this is what is called a local coordinate system. A local coordinate system is one of those charts. Now, a collection of charts, so if we have several of such maps, I use the word maps, right? It's a map from here to here. If we have several of those, then together they can form what is called an atlas. Maybe you remember from geography in high school, right? These atlas things, it's a collection of maps. So here, a collection of maps is called an atlas. If the union of the regions that UI that these charts cover, the union actually covers the entire thing. Now, what about changes of coordinate system? what are they in this picture here? Yeah?
Do the charts have to be finite, like have a finite number or?
Finite number of charts?
Yeah.
No, in principle, you can make that infinite.
Oh, okay.
We won't need that, but you could.
Mm-hmm. I just want to confirm, does U have to be open, or can it be?
I'm not sure, but I think it's fine if it's just subsets.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have a quick question. So, we are using local a lot, and
local just means not all of it.
Yeah, that is what is bothering me because we haven't assigned any structure to the manifold.
Well, that's right. Local doesn't mean small because we don't know what is small, what is large.
Yeah.
We don't have any notion of distance on it. We are still free to assign any notion of distance to this. It's very important. I mean, for example, imagine you have a map. Like these old-fashioned maps from an atlas. And imagine that the map is not made out of paper, but out of a very flexible material, right? And then we can, by just pulling on the material, we can make a distance look large. We can make a distance look small, right? So similarly here, by choosing our coordinate system, we can make, it's just not defined what distances are. We can still later define what is the actual distance between points. That's when we get into the metric and the curvature and we describe the actual shape. So far, we are just describing the continuity of the manifold. And the next thing now is that we will describe the differentiability of the manifold. So continuity is like its chewing gum nature, right? And then the differentiability of, I mean, chewing gum can rip, right? And we are saying, no, it's not ripping. But then now we are checking whether it has kinks, right? Or something like that is non-differentiable. That could also be. Okay, so okay, that's a coordinate system. And now a collection of these will be an atlas if they cover everything. And now, let's say we have two charts and we want to do a change of coordinate system. So here is our total topological manifold. U1 is a region that the coordinate system H1 maps into Rn. And U2 is a region that the coordinate system H2 maps into Rn. I mean, the chart H2. It's really just a map, right? It's a continuous invertible map that preserves the topologies. And let's say that they have an overlap. This means that any point in here, any space-time event, once we apply this to space-time, any point in here can now be described by two different coordinates. We can choose this coordinate system and we get an n-tuple for a particular point, but the same point could also be mapped using h2 into Rn, and then it has a different n-tuple that describes that point. Which means that we can do a change of coordinates. How does that work? Remember that these charts have to be not only continuous, also invertible. That's cool, because it means that we can take a point in here, which stands for a point in there, because it's coordinate system, it's invertible map, and we can map it from here into the manifold, and then from the manifold back into this coordinate system. And in this way, a change of coordinates is a map from Rn into Rn. So we can write it in this way. H12 is a change of coordinate map, and it works this way. It's H1 inverse, so it's this map, but inverse. So I put a minus 1 here. And then this little circle here means concatenation. It means once you're done with this operation, perform that operation. And then I could have another little circle, another operation, and so on and so on. But that just means concatenation of operations, right? So we do first that map, and then we do this map. So that maps a point. Any point in here gets mapped into a point in there, which then gets mapped into a point in here. OK, so that's a change of coordinates map. And but here we go. And now, we are on familiar territory. H12 is an object that we can work with. You see, H1 is a weird thing. It's mathematically well defined. Yeah, it just maps points in here into points in there. But how do you actually do that in practice, right? How do you nail down what point you mean in here? You need to have a coordinate system to start with to do that, right? So it's hard to write down H1 itself unless you can actually count those points or something, or they have names by other means or whatever. But the map H12 is a map from Rn into Rn. And in particular, we know what differentiability means for maps from Rn into Rn. So we can ask, is this thing differentiable or not? So for maps from Rn into Rn, we know what differentiability means. And so let's adopt the following strategy. Let us define the differentiability of an atlas. Remember, collection of so many charts that together they cover the manifold. Let's define the differentiability of an atlas through the differentiability, if it exists, of its chart changes. So we say that an atlas, a collection of coordinate systems, is called CR differentiable. So it's R times continuously differentiable. So you can take this map from Rn into Rn and differentiate it R times, and what you get is still a continuous function. You should have seen this in calculus 3 or 4, that you can actually differentiate vector-valued functions multiple times. You know, for example, for the purpose of Taylor expansion of functions from Rn to Rn. You may have seen this. You get the Hessian matrix and stuff like that. But you get higher and higher stuff, right? With more Hessian matrix is just a matrix. You go another derivative, you have three indices, and then four and five and so on. Anyway, so an atlas is called CR differentiable if all of its coordinate changes, H alpha beta, are CR diffeomorphisms, that is to say that they are R times continuously differentiable. Okay, so we know what it means that a change of coordinate map is continuously differentiable at times, and an atlas, which is a collection of charts that cover the manifold, is also called CR differentiable if all of its charts are R times differentiable. But remember, this is still not a definition for what it means that the manifold is differentiable. This is just a definition for what it means that the changes of charts are differentiable. So now our strategy will be this. Enlarge a given atlas so that every point of the manifold is in multiple charts. Then the differentiability of the manifold is definable through the atlas differentiability. Okay, so the definition is that if a CR differentiable atlas A if we are given a set of charts for which all of the change of coordinate systems are CR differentiable, then we can generate a maximal CR differentiable atlas by adding all possible coordinate systems as well, whose chart changes with charts in A are also differentiable that many times. See, what this means is this. We can have an atlas which consists of so many coordinate systems that together they cover the manifold. But we may be stingy with this. We may have just barely enough coordinate systems that they cover the manifold, right? And there may be little or even no overlap between those coordinate systems. And so it's easy to find that when there is an overlap, then we have differentiability. But we want something more. We want that we have, for all possible charts that we can put there, they all must be such that they are all having that differentiability structure. And if we have that, then we say that this is a differentiable structure of class CR for that manifold. Right? So it's the maximal atlas that we can have, such that all of the coordinate changes are R times differentiable. And then finally, we obtain that a differentiable manifold of class CR, R times continuously differentiable, is a topological manifold which possesses a maximal atlas of class CR. That is to say, with a differentiable structure of class CR. That's just how we call it. We say that this is a differentiable structure. So previously, we started with a set. Then we added a topological structure to it. And from that, we got the continuity, right? So we had the continuous structure on it. And now we're adding the differentiable structure to it. Differentiable structure is given by those coordinate change maps.
So if the atlas consists of just one chart, then trivially, because the only transition map is the identity map, then trivially the manifold differentiability would mean that the scalar function is differentiable on any point on the chart.
Not scalar function. You would have the changes of coordinates.
Any function, if it is differentiable on the manifold, which has just only one chart, then we can extend that to the entire manifold. Because there's no chart.
Yeah, if the manifold has only one chart, yes. But then we can still have chart changes, right?
But that with the identity map, because you mean we have to consider all the chart changes?
Yeah, we have to ask, can we have chart changes that are differentiable at times, even if one of them covers the entire manifold? Because it's two issues, yeah. Whether a chart change is differentiable,
right.
And the other issue is whether a chart change is on a subspace of the manifold that is covering all of it, or how many overlaps do we have to have so that all the overlaps together cover the manifold?
Right.
That's a separate issue. That's
right.
Going from local to global.
Right.
But also locally, the question is, are there differentiable chart changes?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, and then remember that this is, what we did is a kind of a bootstrap here. We are saying we know how to differentiate functions from Rn into Rn, and we know how to define differentiability R times. And we use that, we recruit that to define then in this indirect way what we mean by the differentiability of a manifold. So basically, roughly speaking, the differentiability of a manifold is the differentiability of its coordinate changes. Now, the best case differentiability of its coordinate changes, right? Because it didn't, let me give you an example. You could choose a manifold as simple, as easy as Rn, and then choose a coordinate system on it that's not continuous, a coordinate system that jumps, right? So like from here to here, we go linear, and then, right. Now, and then you have a coordinate system change, and then that map from Rn to Rn is going to be discontinuous. That's not the fault of Rn. It's the fault of us choosing an awkward coordinate system. That doesn't make Rn non-continuous or non-differentiable, right? And here we always talked about, do there exist charts such that we have this much differentiability? Of course, there will always charts. There will always be charts and chart changes that do not have differentiability. No, and this is the best case, right? So the manifold inherits the differentiability of the best choices of charts that we can put on there. And now there's a theorem that's a bit surprising, and that's why I said earlier that differentiability for manifolds is somewhat different from differentiability of functions that live on a manifold. So the theorem by Whitney is this. Every k times continuously differentiable structure with k larger or equal to 1, so at least once continuously differentiable, is is equivalent to a C infinity structure. So what that means is that if, by this definition, you find that your manifold is once continuously differentiable, meaning that you find a maximum atlas such that all the coordinate changes are at least once continuously differentiable, then it turns out, by this theorem of Whitney, then actually you will also find coordinate changes which are infinitely many times continuously differentiable. That's certainly not true for regular functions, right? If a function is once continuously differentiable, that doesn't guarantee that it's a second time continuously differentiable. But for manifolds, it is. And the reason is that it's not the same functions, right? It says, you found an atlas such that, a maximum atlas, such that all of the changes of coordinates are once continuously differentiable. And then Whitney says, well, then I can construct for you changes of coordinates, different changes of coordinates, different charts, different changes of coordinates, such that you have arbitrarily high differentiability, continuous differentiability, which means the following. It means that if a manifold has differentiability once, then it is what is called smooth. It's smooth is another word for C infinity, right? It's smooth. Which means that if it is differentiable, then, and you find that in your coordinate system, in your choice of charts, the changes of coordinates are not differentiable as many times, maybe not 5 times differentiable, only once, then too bad for your choice of coordinate systems, right? It's not to do with the manifold. The manifold intrinsically, if it has C1, it will have C infinity. Right? So whenever you have that your change of coordinates is discontinuous, if you find that the change of coordinates is, after so many differentiations, it's discontinuous, so it's not C infinity, then it's because of the change of coordinates that you chose. It's because of the coordinate systems that you chose. This means that the terminology can be adopted that any C1 manifold is, since it is C infinity, we also will call it simply a smooth manifold. But again, we have to be careful with intuition because we have no notion of distance. We have no notion of curvature on these manifolds. We can think of it in this way, that if a manifold, but we don't have curvature on it, right? But an intuition that is plausible, perhaps, is that a manifold could be like a plane, and then not differentiable because change of direction there, right? But if you smoothen it a bit so that it's actually once differentiable, right, then there's always a coordinate system, so it stays smooth. It's a weird thing. It wouldn't be true for functions, right? And that's why we can't think of it as really like that, because that would be the picture of functions, and we know that. If you smoothen it for the first derivative, you haven't smoothed it for the second derivative. But for manifolds, that's the case. Okay, so that's as far as we got today. And we will continue building up the mathematics. Remember, that's the first part of the course. And then once we've built up all of the mathematics, then we will describe general relativity with these tools. And then finally, we do applications to cosmology and black holes.